Hi everyone, welcome back. I am back in Dublin this week and I'm joined by the lovely Hazel Lynn Doyle. Thank you, Hazel Lynn, for being here today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. So we are obviously going to sit down and have a conversation about, I suppose, one of the most important people in your life, your lovely dad, Derek. And from what I've been chatting to you, I feel like he was such a character and I would love to hear about him. So your mom is here with you today as well. She's Tanya. So Tanya and Derek, tell me about your dad.
My dad was, I know everybody says they love their mommy and daddy, but like my dad was the most amazing man in the world. You know, so I'm an only child, no brothers and sisters, just myself. So I was very, very close to my dad. So my dad was in the army, you know, so growing up, I probably had about 20 dads, all the army men.
Okay.
So my mom would have travelled with my dad before they had me.
Really?
Yeah, they travelled. So my dad was in the 5th Battalion. So he would have been in Lebanon, peacekeeping, and mom actually travelled with him.
Okay.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Because back then, families would go with them.
Yeah, okay. My mum would have travelled with my dad.
Right.
Now, bear in mind, mum and dad are together since they were 16.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a long, long, long time. Yeah. They were really good friends. And then we'll fast forward then a couple of years, then they had me.
Okay.
Were
they in Dublin when they had you?
Yeah, so we're originally from Cabra.
Okay.
So mum and dad had bought their house in Cabra and they were living there a couple of years. We're married and all by 21, 22.
Okay.
And then they had me.
Lovely.
So at the time, mum was a hairdresser and dad would have been just left the army and he would have been working in the Air Corps. So my dad loved planes.
Did he?
Oh my God, absolutely. Like that's a memory that I remember growing up. My dad would have brought me to the air shows.
Okay.
All the time. Anytime there was a plane. We used to go watch the planes actually over in Dublin Airport.
Yeah.
That was something we always done together. He knew every plane. My dad knew everything.
Okay.
You know, one of those, like he knew even the other day in work, somebody was asking me a question and it's that split reality where I'm like, I'll just ask my dad and then you know you can't.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so he was the person you would go to for everything.
The answer for everything.
Oh my God, he was so funny.
What was he like with you? Were you like, you know, could do no wrong, apple of his eye?
Yeah. I think, you know what, like I loved my mom and dad, but I think I appreciated them a lot more as I got older. You know, I think everybody is the exact same, but my dad was my pal.
You know, growing up like as an only child then, like you get your parents' undivided attention, like.
Oh my God.
I loved that.
Yeah, I did. And people would have said to me and still say to me, oh, you're an only child, you must have been spoiled rotten. No, my dad had me out to work at 16.
Stop.
Oh yeah. So I was doing my leave and cert, out to work, handing up your few bob. Now, come here, never went without. More times he gave it back to me.
Yeah, yeah. But he was teaching you.
Oh my God. Like I am the way I am today because of my mom and my dad.
Yeah.
Like he's a very hard worker.
Yeah.
Oh my God. This is where I get my work ethic from. My dad was such a hard worker. He was a family man. He really provided. And he loved his two girls. Me and my mom.
Yeah. And he went on to work in Leinster House as an usher.
Yeah, yeah. So dad would have left the army and he would have went into the Air Corps where he met his best friend, Alan Aston. And Alan is just my dad's best friend to this day. Alan lives down in Galway. We're actually going down to spend Christmas with Alan this year.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, if my dad was here, he would have loved that. My dad was always going down to Alan. That's where they met in the Air Corps.
Right.
And my dad would have done air, sea and rescue.
Did he?
He did, yeah. He done the air, sea and
rescue. Would he be flying the planes? No.
No.
No, no.
No, just he worked on the government jets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? The stories.
Like as security almost, is it?
No, he was like, he worked in the Air Corps, he worked on the planes with the government jets. So he would have been working on the planes.
On the plane, like
yeah,
engineer.
With ministers and stuff like that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was out in Baldonnell. So when I was younger, mum used to go and collect dad from work with me in the back of the car out to Baldonnell. And I remember going out because my dad would finish work late. So mum would put me in the back of the car. And we'd go over and collect dad in Baldonnell.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then as later years went on then, I think, which is quite sad as well, I think, you know, when my dad was killed, he was at the most content of his life, which is really sad. Yeah. Like, he loved his job.
Yeah.
He went into being an usher in Leinster House. And most of army women and men, that's where they go.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he loved Leinster House, and his pals in Leinster House, most of them, you know, like they know, like Eddie and Greg, his best pals, they were all in the army. They had so much in common.
Okay.
So, and then with Mam being a public rep and Dad working in Leinster House, he loved it. Loved it. Mm. Very political.
Yeah.
Yeah, very political.
Very important to your family, I suppose, your mum, your dad.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
Political life.
Oh, very. But yeah. He loved Leinster.
So he obviously had plenty of opinions, I'm sure, on different things.
Yeah, he did. Dad would never force his opinion on you. Never. He used to just say, everyone has opinions, you know, and you don't force your opinion on anybody. Everybody has them. He said, not everybody wants to listen to them, but everybody has them. But he was very, very knowledgeable. He knew an awful lot.
Okay.
An awful lot about politics.
Right, okay.
Like him and my mum worked side by side.
Wow.
Yeah.
In government buildings?
Yeah, so Mam would be a local rep, so she wouldn't be in the government building.
Yeah.
She would be in like our local authority with council meetings and stuff. But with Dad being, you know, so political and then working in Leinster House, you know, he would have been Mam's director of electors for the 2 times she ran for elections. And Dad would have been her director of electors. So he knew it. He'd done everything.
Yeah.
Everything. And he always advised her. Yeah, he's a very big supporter of my Mam's career.
Wow.
Very, very big.
Wow.
Yeah.
So family was absolutely everything to him.
Family was my dad's everything.
And everything he did, he stood behind you and supported you.
Absolutely. Like, even when I was younger. So my dad used to say he got the best of both worlds. He got a boy and a girl. He got Hazel and Harry. Because although I'm a girly girl, my dad had me playing GAA. Yeah, for years. So he used to come to all my matches. I played in goals. He never missed a football game. Never. He'd be at the sidelines. Even like, so Mam would have been the hairdresser at the time. So Mam worked Saturdays. So that was our day. Me and my dad's day. So like, we used to call it Don Don Day. And it was McDonald's. And we'd go to the cinema. And we'd go to see 2 or 3 movies. We'd go to McDonald's. We'd spend the day together and then collect Mam from work. So Saturdays were our days. Even scouts trips. I was in scouts when I was younger. He never missed anything. School plays. Again, with Mam being a hairdresser, she would have cut her hours. And she would have done a full week in 3 days. So Dad was turning up the school plays. I never went without. No, like, I really didn't.
Mm.
You know, he made sure he was at everything.
And you knew you were loved.
Oh my God, more than loved.
Yeah.
Like, more than loved. Yeah. Like, that's something that I always say, I'm so lucky to have a Mam and Dad like that. So lucky, because I never wanted for anything. You know, I always felt loved. You know, Mam and Dad always pushed me to do better. They were never too hard on me, but they always pushed me to do well and get a good job, set yourself up for life. I never worried. Never worried. And any advice I needed, Dad always gave it to me. Very lucky.
Mm.
Like, very, very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Very lucky.
Coming up to Christmas, we are coming up to Christmas now, which is a really difficult time of the year for many people. And I just wanted to quickly ask you, what was Christmas like for you with your dad growing up, even in later years?
Yeah.
Did he love Christmas?
Yeah, Dad did love Christmas. Yeah, he loved putting up the Christmas tree.
Yeah.
So then growing up, you know, we would have like a Christmas day and putting the Christmas tree up, and we'd watch White Christmas, that old movie. Always watched White Christmas. It is going back to when you put a DVD into the player, and would always get a takeaway. Always. And Dad loved McFlurries from McDonald's. Loved them. So that was always the dessert that we got.
Oh, class.
But yeah, loved his dinner.
Mm.
Like, loved his Christmas dinner. And Mam would always make Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
So we'd do Christmas Day in my house. And then Stephen's Day, we would go down to my Mam's brother, which is my godfather, on Stephen's Day. And Dad would go. He loves Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah, loved his dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So last year, you were in the run-up to Christmas.
Yeah.
It was the 19th of December.
Yeah.
Can you, I suppose, tell us maybe about that day or what was happening for you and what was happening with your dad and your mum, and I suppose on that day, ultimately in so much as you can talk about, because I do understand with something like this, there are things you can and you cannot say. But in so much as you can, tell us what was happening on that day.
Yeah, so, you know, lead up to Christmas, Mam had just gone through a local election. That was to July. I got the first seat. She'd done very well. We're very proud of her. And we had said as a family, we said, the general is coming up. Let's do it. You know, you get one chance. I said, let's do it as a family. So coming up towards Christmas was very, very busy for us as a family. We're constantly out canvassing. Like, we were always together, but it wasn't spending time because we were canvassing. We were here, we were there. I was still working. So it was very hard to actually be a family at that time. So Mam had said, you know, coming to the end of the election's done now. This is our time. And this is our time as a family. We're going to slow down now, start spending time together and have a nice chilled Christmas. So take it maybe to the 18th of December was the night before the 19th. You know, we were getting ready for Christmas. Like you would as a normal person. I was getting my hair done. You know, Mam was doing her bits on the laptop. And, you know, the hairdresser actually said to me a couple of days after that, she says, I'll never forget the night before. She said, you were walking me out to the door. She said, and I looked into the sitting room. She said, and your mum and dad were sitting beside each other on the sofa. And that was them. They were never without each other. So we all went to bed. It was about 11:30 and dad was up early going to work. I was up early. Mam had a council meeting. So we said, we'll all best off. We were all sitting on the sofa, the three of us. I said, we'll head to bed. I said, normal. See you tomorrow. You know, night dad, love you. Say night pal, love you. And see you tomorrow after work. So at the time I was getting my room done up. So I actually had no blinds in my room. We were waiting to get new blinds. So dad would be was out the back getting his bike ready for work. Dad cycled for years. But he had only got the bike to work scheme in the September. Because he just said public transport, trying to get into the Dáil, it was taking too long for him. And it was too packed. So he said, he was very fit. He said, I'm going to start cycling. So he'd only got the bike. So when he was out the back that morning putting his battery in the bike, I seen the flashing lights. Because he was out the back, I was getting up for work, I seen his flashing lights and off he went to work. I went to work. You know, everyone's buzzing. It's Christmas. Everyone at work is flying around, getting their bits. I work beside Blanchardstown Centre. Everyone was flying over, getting their Christmas bits. I was on the front counter that day and Mam had our council meeting. So I had text her and I said, when you're finished, let me know and we'll head home together. So we'll say this was about 5 o'clock, say 5:15, maybe a little after. Mam said, I'm ready, we'll head off. So I'd finished up, so I finished at 5. And now looking back on it now, I got a really, really sick stomach at 4:30. And I don't know what it was, I just felt really ill. Really, really ill at 4:30. That time we didn't know anything. So everybody was walking by the desk in work and everyone was saying, oh God, you know, did you hear Castleknock is shut off? Nobody can get down the M50. No one can get up the Navan Road. Castleknock is all closed off. A man in his 50s has been killed. So we'd heard all this and had no idea. You don't think it's going to be you. You don't. You don't think it's going to be. I never thought it was going to be me. So myself and Mam were going home in the car and I had seen all over it popped up on social media and it said, Castleknock closed off, you can't get through. Cyclist in his 50s killed instantly. Again, you don't think anything. So I was meeting my friends for a Christmas drink. I went home, got changed, and I said to Mam, I'm flying out, I'll be an hour. And she had said, I'm going down to get something for the dinner, I'll pop it in the oven, your dad will have it when he comes home, and I'll leave some for you. That's a normal day. This year, that's a normal day. So I left. My friend picked me up outside. I was there, we'll say 15 minutes. And Mam rang. And I guess she would never really ring because if she knew where I was going, she'd just say Hazel would be home. So when she rang, I thought it was a bit strange. And I answered the phone. I said, Mam, is everything okay? And it wasn't Mam on the phone. It was a guard. And he said, Hazel, this is... Garda from Blanchestown Garda Station. He said, you need to start making your way home. And I says, my mum okay? And he said, yeah, yeah. He says, your mum is fine. And I go to my dad straight away. So I said, is everything okay with my dad? He said, no. He said, no, everything's not okay. So I said, is he after falling off his bike? That's the first. I knew he was coming home from work. But see, bear in mind, dad wasn't meant to leave work till 5 o'clock that day.
Okay.
He left early. So nothing popped into my mind that that's the time dad would have been travelling home.
Yeah.
So he said, it is your dad. And I said, well, what hospital is he in? I said, it'll be quicker for me to get to the hospital than to come home. And he said, Hazel, your dad is not in the hospital. And I said, well, what hospital is he in? I said, I'll meet you there. He said, no, Hazel, he said, your dad's after being killed in a very serious accident. He said, you need to come home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Over the phone?
Yeah. And that's just, that's when our whole world just literally done a 360. So I can't remember leaving and getting home. I just remember my friend drove. I remember getting home and driving down the road, and there was 3 unmarked Garda cars outside the house. There was 6 detectives. And I just remember getting out of the car, and I was walking up the driveway, and was these 2 men in yellow jackets, and they were like giants to me. They looked like giants. They weren't. But at that moment, I knew there was something wrong, and they just looked so big. Standing there, and they said, Hazel, can you come into the house? And still at that stage, I didn't. Even though he had told me, I still didn't register. I think that was part of me still not wanting to believe what had happened. So got into the house and into the sitting room. Mum was sitting on the sofa over in the corner, and I just knew by her. I just knew by her. And she said she didn't say anything to me. The guard just said, can you sit down? And he said to me, look, he said, your dad's after being killed coming home from work. And I said, no, my dad. He said, how do you know it's my dad? And he said to me, my dad had still his lanyard on from work. That said, Derek Doyle. So the guards knew, obviously with Mam being a public rep, Derek Doyle is her husband. The guard said, no, he said, he was killed instantly. He was dead on the scene. And I couldn't tell you. I just remember a bit of time after that, I was pacing. I was pacing the house. I was walking into the kitchen, back into the sitting room, back in. I was just doing circles. It's like my body was trying to, I don't know what my body was trying to do. I just couldn't take it in. And I didn't want to sit down because I couldn't. So he had said, the guard had said to me, can I ring? I need to ring members of your family. And this is where my dad would be the exact same. You just go straight into fight mode and you just do what you have to do. My dad was like that. So I said, no, I said, I'll do it. Like, I'm not having anybody else ring any of my, it's not right. You know, and my dad wouldn't have wanted that. So my dad has one sister. She passed away a couple of years ago. Okay, so my mum has this one brother, my godfather, and his wife. So I rang them. And straight away, they said, we'll be up to the house. So I think, you know, everything had started fizzling around. People had started hearing. You know, there was people on the scene, there was witnesses. They were getting on to people. You know, things were filtering back. And people were saying, that's Hazel Instad, that's Tanya's husband. So all our friends and family, you know, and neighbours, they had all started coming to the house. I can't remember them being there. Like, I can't. I remember my best friend, Lauren, she was there. My godfather, his wife. I couldn't tell you who else was in the house. And to this day, I still can't. It's like my brain wants to block it out.
Yeah, it's so foggy.
Oh, so, and that's such a big part of grief, brain fog.
Mm.
You know, so that night, I can't tell you whether we slept that night or not. I mean, mom was collapsed and she was getting sick. We had to call it in on call. Like, remember, this is 5 days before Christmas as well. So there's nothing, like, everything's slowing down, you know. So we had to try and get an on call doctor for my mom, and they wouldn't see both of us. So they were coming to the one house, but the doctor wouldn't see both of us. We needed two separate appointments. So we said, look, we'll get the doctor for mom. And it was the next morning, the doctor called out. Again, I can't tell you what happened between that night. And I couldn't even tell you if someone stayed in the house between that night and the next morning. It's a complete block.
Yeah.
You know, the doctor came that morning and had seen mom. And then people started coming to the house. You know, it was bright out, so I would have assumed it was the next morning.
Yeah.
You know, we're a very well put together family. So we both went up, had our showers and got dressed. You know, people started coming to the house. Reality hadn't set in.
Yeah.
Hadn't set in. You know, I have a lot of amazing friends in my job. Like, I'm so lucky to have them. When they heard, they came straight up to the house. If they said they were there, I don't remember speaking to them.
God.
I don't remember speaking to them. The next stage that I do remember is a guard coming into the house and saying, Hazel Lynn, we have something very, very hard to ask you. And my godfather had already known. He said, we can't identify your dad's body. And it's looking like 10 days to get what's left of his body released from the coroner or the morgue. He was in Conley Hospital. We need you to give your DNA to identify him. So again, yeah, I have to. You know, I want my dad home. We kept my mom very far away from this. We kept her in the kitchen. Her friends were with her. It's just not something my mom needed to see. It's not. They brought me into the sitting room, cleared the sitting room out. There was two men in white suits, white forensic suits. There was a motorbike sitting outside ready to take the DNA. There was a guard taking notes. And then there was, I would say, a superintendent, a high-up guard that would give permission for all this to happen. And my godfather sat beside me. And he said, this is going to be very hard, Hazel. He said, but you're going to do it for your dad. And I just sat there like this. I gave my both two arms out. They took lock of hair. They took blood samples. They took saliva swabs, a couple of them. And every time I gave a piece of my body to identify my dad, I had to sign a piece of paper. And even at that, I still kept saying, this is going to come back, it's not my dad. It's going to come back, it's not him. He still hadn't come home from work, so I knew it was him. It was like my last piece of hope. It's my last piece of hope that my dad hasn't been taken from us. You know, so I think that's a big thing that I struggle with. You know, it's something I'll never be able to get over or forget, that in order to identify my dad's body, I had to give a piece of me. You don't ever come back from that. Went on a motorbike, and off the motorbike went, and it was 10 days. We were waiting 10 days from the 19th of December. 10 days to get a closed coffin home.
I don't know where or how or what. I can't comprehend that.
Yeah.
Part of everything. What you must go through mentally.
Yeah.
To know that you have to give DNA to identify. So you have to sit at home then for 10 full days.
10 full days.
Of torture.
Torture.
Mental torture and anguish.
Oh my God.
not knowing where he is, I suppose, and knowing. And in the middle of all of this, Christmas Day rolls around.
Of course. Yeah, people are, you know, putting up their pictures on social media and they're, I suppose, getting on with their life, you know, and we're below underground right now. We're at the lowest that I think, well, at the time I thought it was the lowest you could ever be. Now I know that it was a long road yet to come. It was 10 days, Christmas Day. We were invited to go to family and friends. No. You know, we, a couple of days after that, DNA obviously came back and my godfather had to actually go down and just go in and sign off, I suppose. And they released Dad and he went to a funeral home across the road. So we spent the days after Christmas Day, a couple of days after, sitting there in the sitting room, looking across the road, known, and actually the funeral home left the lights on for us. So we sat in our sitting room, looking across, knowing that Dad's in there. And we couldn't go see him. Yeah, I brought over, you know, a couple of items to put in with Dad. And his favourite suit. We brought that over and I went into the funeral home and done across the road. And I had said to the man in the funeral home, I'd said, "Is my dad in there?" He said, "Yeah, he is." And that means the door is right here. And I said, "Please." I said, "Can I just see him?" He said, "Hazel, I can't." He said, "You won't come back on what you'll see." He said, "I can't let you in." So having to leave the funeral home and know that my dad was in there, we couldn't say goodbye to him. You know, the days after that, planning Dad's funeral, I just, Mam pleaded with the funeral home. She said, "Can I just hold Derek's hand?" Again, he said, "There's nothing there to, like, I can't." He said, "I can't let you." So Dad went to work that morning. Never came home. And when we eventually got, say, Dad home, it was closed coffin. And there was no way that they were letting that coffin be open. It's just soul destroying. It's absolutely soul destroying.
Yes. It really is. You know, it makes me think a lot about your dad.
Yeah.
To think that it makes me feel lonely, like that nobody could touch him. Say, "You're okay, we love you."
That's,
do you know what I mean?
That's what we struggle with.
Yeah.
And that is something that, again, myself and Mam will forever struggle with, because we can't get that time back.
Yeah.
And the thoughts of him, that's why the funeral home left the lights on.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Mick in the funeral home, he said, "I went in Christmas Day. I went in a couple of days later. Your dad wasn't on his own."
Oh.
But then, you know, there's still so much that plays in your mind. You know, Dad was obviously, well, from what we know or we've been told, Dad was dead on the scene. He was on his own. Dad's never been on his own. He's never been apart from me and my mum.
And then, did he know what was happening? Did he know? Did he get a fright? You know what our liaison officer, our guarded liaison officer, has told us. Dad was found stuck under the front left wheel. Still on his bike. How long was he there? Was he alive before the guards got there? That's all something that we have to wait for the coroner's inquest, which we've been told will take 18 to 24 months. So we're living every day like Groundhog Day. Not known what happened. You know, we know the road my dad was travelling. We know he was going straight and it was a fully loaded HGV cement truck. Was turning left. The left is a blind spot. It's not good enough. If people are aware that there is a left blind spot on a tipper that big, not roadworthy. In my opinion, It's not roadworthy. And I'm sick of hearing the excuse it was a blind spot. Because if you're aware it's a blind spot, you shouldn't be on the road. The truck, you know, in residential areas, Dad was killed in a residential area. Schools, you know, the community of Castleknock have been really, really good to us. Dad was killed in Castleknock and they actually organised a vigil for my dad.
So lovely.
And I couldn't tell you when that was. I just know it was in them 10 days because them 10 days are like one day to me.
That's so beautiful that they did that, isn't it?
It was, Mum wasn't able to go. I went.
Did you?
I did, yeah, because I just, my dad never let me down. Ever. And I wasn't letting him down. All over the papers and all over the news, they kept saying, man in his 50s. Killed. And I wanted to use that time to tell people, no, he has a name. He's a dad. He's a husband. His name is Derek Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I said to people, his name was Derek Doyle. I said, and he was loved. He was on his way home from work to his family. Never made it home.
Those 10 days, you know, knowing that you had to wait for him to be identified and ultimately then being told, obviously you're waiting for someone to say, well, can we see him? And then somebody, obviously guards or whatever, tell you that you won't be able to see him. Like, is that what I would expect it to be? Just excruciatingly traumatizing.
I hope you never have to understand that feeling or feel that feeling. My heart is broken.
Physical pain.
Oh, and to be told, to have some sort of hope that we can go to the funeral home, we might be able to see Dad, give him a kiss, tell him we love him. To be told that no matter what, that's not happening. It's soul destroying.
I can't imagine it.
It's devastating.
I can't imagine the anxiety that it would give you, but no, I need to touch him. Like, I need to. And you're being told no.
It's wanting, it's like you're not in control.
Yeah.
And somebody else is, which, you know, he was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
There's no way.
I understand
There's
that.
There's no way.
Yeah.
But if you had said to me, Hazelyn, you can, I would have said yeah.
I know.
I would have. Because Dad's gone. We can never, ever say goodbye to him.
Yeah.
You know, I'm terrified. I forget what he looks like.
Because as time goes on, I call it grief brain. Grief brain is just in full mode right now.
Yeah.
I forget everything.
Yeah.
I don't remember. You know, I'm only back to work 3 months. And the reality is, you know, people don't, grief is not spoken about. It's like people are just trying to hide away from it.
Yeah.
But grief is going to come to everybody. You know, I hope nobody has to experience the grief and trauma and PTSD that myself and my mom are going through. But grief will come to your door at some stage. And what's not spoken about with grief, I find, you know, is it's not like it is in the movies. You know?
Yeah, it's so much worse than
that. It's so much worse.
Yeah.
The paperwork.
Yeah.
The financial burden. That's such a big factor of grief.
Yeah, you're so right.
You know, it's such a big factor, you know, changing over names. We've no death cert. We've nothing.
So that makes everything so complicated to try to
try and
close accounts.
Even pay a bill.
Yeah.
You know, you find out who's there for you and you find out who's not there for you. People will be there at the start and God, they could be there for days. It's not, you don't need them then. You need people 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 months down the line.
Yeah, and years down the line.
Yeah.
2 years, three years.
That's when, you know, and I don't know about yourself, but, you know, the stuff, I think people are afraid.
I think when it's something, I think the how becomes very important as well.
Mm.
When it shouldn't, because at the end of the day, okay, it should for two reasons.
Yeah.
What you're dealing with, the trauma and the PTSD.
Yeah.
We can't overlook that. You know what I mean? That's so different. No one could say, oh, I get what you're going through, because you don't, because it's so different.
Grief is individual alone.
100%. But I think that were your dad to have passed away in bed, people would be more comfortable to say, and how are you doing? Whereas they get frightened by something that's really traumatic, like suicides and
absolutely
murder and all of these really not common everyday occurrences. People get really stiff and they go silent and they run away.
Yeah.
And it's awful, because at the end of the day, you've lost your dad the way someone else's dad, as what I mean is they're not here. So it's not the same thing for me to say, oh, sure, you know. But what I mean is, at the end of the day, you're missing your dad like someone else misses their dad.
Absolutely.
But the focus is all on the how. And of course, we're talking about that today because it's relevant for people to understand what you go through on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And the trauma that you experience. It's so relevant to talk about that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you're just a girl missing her daddy.
Yeah.
And people need to be comfortable enough to go, how are you, Hazelyn?
Like, yeah,
you know, arm around you and this is a hard time for you.
Yes.
And talk about your dad. What would your dad be at now? Would he be getting ready for, you know, Christmas?
Yeah.
Don't
run away from me when you see me.
It becomes about the how, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And not spoken about with grief, and people lose weight, people put weight on. People exercise, people don't. People pick up hobbies, people don't. Grief is so individual. My grief is I have lost a lot of weight. And comments, people are so, my opinion for people going through, people are so judgmental.
Yeah.
Like the amount of times that has been said to me, oh, what's your secret, Hazel? You've lost so much weight. What is your secret? And I'm like, do you actually want me to say to you, oh, my dad was killed, he was,
and I haven't physically been able to eat since.
Yeah, that's how I've lost all that weight, because every time I put food in my mouth, I feel physically ill. I get sick every single morning. I get sick every morning. And I don't sleep.
Yeah.
I don't sleep because I'm terrified to sleep, because I have to relive it all over again.
When you wake or when you sleep, in your nightmares?
Well, yeah, the nightmares are, oh, my mum is the same. The nightmares are traumatic.
I wasn't at the scene, but I keep imagining my dad being carried off in a body bag. I wasn't there. You know, or we're walking, we're anywhere, and a truck drives by us. Myself and my mum's eye goes to the front left wheel, and we see my dad under it. That's the trauma and the PTSD. We tense. We see cyclists, or we're on the M50, and a big truck drives by us. Our bodies tense up.
Yeah.
Our bodies tense up.
Fear. Almost.
It's fear.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, grief is happening. It's going to keep happening. And people shouldn't be afraid to speak about it.
Yeah.
You know.
And it is, like you said, so complex.
Yeah.
You know, it's not straightforward, but it's, I don't know, we need to be better equipped to give space to people and support anything that might come up. You need to be able to hear it, witness it, support in whatever way you can, but people just shy away from it.
Just shy. And this whole thing of people saying, oh, like, I find it too hard to come see us. You know, that's a big thing that people say to myself and my mum. Yeah. Yeah. I find, are they using it as an excuse? I don't know. But I find it too hard to come to the house and see yourself and Tanya. Yeah, I find it way too hard. And we're at the angry stage now in grief, where we're kind of like, why is it hard for you to come and see us? We're the ones going through this.
Yeah.
So I think grief is, I don't think we have started.
Yeah, we were chatting before, weren't we?
Yeah.
Before we came on here.
Yeah.
And like, for me, looking at you guys, I'm like, the grief, there's no room even to sit. And, you know, in some ways, the word grief can be, I don't want to, you know, offend anyone by saying this, but grief almost is a gift to you. I don't mean a gift. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying, Jesus.
No, I get you.
I don't want to be sitting across from you. I don't want anyone to experience grief, because it's the worst experience you go through in life is grief. But what I mean is that when you lose somebody, you have to be able to sit in that. You have to be able to feel your grief.
Yeah.
And it's so different for everyone. Some people, you know, I had a lovely lady on who it took her 7 years. You know, she'd lost her husband and her son. And I could understand. She's like, I just couldn't go there. And I'm like, yeah, of course you couldn't go there.
I block it out.
But when you get to a point, like, it's like your grief is precious to you. I don't mean it's a gift. It's precious to you.
It's yours.
Because it's your love for your dad. And it's kind of the opposite side of it.
Yeah.
It's all that love, you know, like that lovely saying, with nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And to be able to sit with that, it brings you back into that relationship, actually, with your dad in a different way.
Yeah. It's very lonely.
Yeah, it's so lonely.
Grief is very lonely.
Yeah.
It's very, very lonely. And we're not lonely. With so many people around us.
But in the meantime, you have this, there's no room for you to sit there and process everything, because you have legalities, you have all of the things. I know that there's a lot that you can't talk about.
Yeah.
So very briefly, your dad was coming home from work and you know that there was a truck, as you say, turning left.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know anything other than that. Is that all that you know or that you can speak about?
So we have a Garda liaison officer. So what we've been told from him is that, you know, dad was found under the front left wheel, stuck under the front left wheel, up against the wall, still on the bike. And, you know, I had said to him, you know, did you go underneath? He said, I did. He said, I crawled underneath from the right-hand side. He says, and I knew by looking at your dad that he was gone. There was a lot of witnesses.
Okay.
They've all given statements.
So all that is to come out?
That's all, yeah. And that will all come out at the coroner's inquest.
How important is that to you? Do you want to know details?
It's my dad's story.
Yeah.
It's my dad's story. It is.
And you need to know?
I can't. I will never be able to move on. I am not the same person I was. I will never be the same person I was. I know my mom doesn't see a future without him. I know I'm young. You know, I turned 30 in June. You know,
first milestone without my dad.
Yeah.
You know, I know I have a long life, please God, ahead of me, but I don't see that now. So we've no closure. Never got to say goodbye. Don't have my dad's phone back. It's all still in evidence. His house keys, his car keys, his AirPods, everything he had with him that day, everything he had in his backpack, is still in evidence. Even simple things of not being able to, his phone's dead now, so I can't even ring it and hear his voice now. You know, so not knowing my dad left work, never made it home, the day of the coroner's inquest will be my dad's story. And I need to know. I need to try, because we're making all these scenarios up in our heads. It's not healthy.
Yeah.
It's really not healthy.
Yeah.
So I need to know.
Yeah, the detail.
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
I suppose it's not, some people probably don't want to know the detail.
No.
But what you already know is horrific enough. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. There isn't much more that could make it more horrific than what you know.
No. No. And to just to think that that's my dad.
I know.
Like, that is just, it's, I can't even explain. I can't explain that hurt and the trauma and the PTSD that come with that. You know, and we need counselling. We need counselling. But the HSE have got back to our doctor and have said that they don't have the resources to deal with the trauma and the PTSD that we're going through and that we're going to continue to go through. So we've no choice than to go private. And bear in mind, there's a wait list there too, and that costs a lot of money.
Yeah, it does.
Costs a lot of money.
It's not fair. You shouldn't have
to
be struggling with that.
No.
Like, you know.
No.
Should be something in.
There's nothing. They don't have, so we've had no counselling. You know, we've had with our GP, it's the system.
Mm. It's not there to support anyone who's struggling.
It's not there to support. It's not. And we can't go public because they don't have anybody and we need such a specific
trauma counseling, informed counselling.
Yeah. You know, we need that.
Yeah. Do you struggle, like, obviously with PTSD? Is that really prevalent for you?
Oh my God. If you look at PTSD in the dictionary, you'll see her name.
Really?
I am riddled.
Really?
Yeah.
What's that like?
It is, I am not myself. I'm speaking to you right now and I am in an outer body. I'm an outer body.
Yeah.
I am not in my body.
Okay.
I can't, like.
You don't feel connected to yourself?
No. It's, I don't know who I am.
Okay.
I don't know who I am. It's, you constantly feel like you have a box around you and you can't see anything around you. You're just concentrating on what's in front of you. But it's blurred vision.
Yeah.
It's blurred vision. Like, I know I'm here and I know I'm speaking to yourself, but I'm not.
Mm.
I'm speaking as in a second person.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's trauma and PTSD.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
you're not necessarily sometimes probably feeling, you're just, you're able to say what happened.
I'm just existing.
Yeah.
No, I am just existing. I'm just existing. I go to work and, you know, it's, I'll be very open. I'm only back to work for financial reasons. I'm not ready to be back.
Yeah.
But like I said, another part of grief that people need to understand, there's a financial burden there. You know, I get to work in the mornings and couldn't tell you how I got there. It's robot. I'm literally running on steam.
Do you feel happiness at all?
No. I'm so detached from my emotions. It's frightening. I do not, because there's nothing to be happy about. There is nothing. I hate myself. My mom is the same.
Why?
I just don't, I hate myself because of how I'm feeling. Because I don't feel like me. You know, and I get up every day and I wash my hair. I have my shower and I put my makeup on. That's my mask. I need that mask. I need that mask to cope and get through the day. Doesn't mean I'm feeling any way better. But that's my way. So if I put my makeup on and, you know, I have my shower and I do my hair, I feel like the old me slightly.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like the old me.
Yeah. It's a ritual almost too.
Yeah, yeah. But then straight back to reality is, no, you're not the old you, Hazel, because your dad's killed.
Mm.
And you bounce straight back.
Everything's so different now.
Everything is, it's completely different. It's like I'm starting a new life.
Yeah, yeah.
That I don't want to do.
I get that.
But I have no choice.
Yeah.
I don't know how to navigate. Yeah.
People don't realise that you kind of, you can die with your person. The old you is gone.
Yeah.
Now you're, it's like you're reborn. You have to start all over again.
Part of me died that day.
To do it.
No, a part of me died that day. Absolutely. My body is sore all the time.
Physically?
Physically. I am sore all the time. My legs are sore all the time. My joints are sore all the time. I have severe headaches. My neck is sore. Every part of my body is sore because I'm hurt. I'm hurt. And that's it's coming out in my body. You know, I can't do crowds. You know, it's something so simple of getting a takeaway. I feel so guilty. I feel so guilty because my dad should be here. And it's the reality of dad didn't die in his sleep. You know, he didn't have a heart attack or like dad's life was taken. And he had no control over that. For him, I'm devastated for him. Because he loved life.
Yeah.
Oh, he loved it.
Needlessly taken. And he was 58. 58 and he's 50. It's like, you know, crazy. Yeah. He had years and years and years ahead
of him. We had said for his 60th, he wanted to go back to New York. And I said, Dad, I'll bring you for your 60th. I was delighted. Absolutely delighted. I can't get that back.
Yeah. You had all these plans for the future.
And it was taken overnight.
Can we talk a little bit about the safety of the roads and for cyclists?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of things that happen. I was saying to you, I feel like I think there's a bad attitude towards cyclists.
Yeah.
Just my own personal opinion is that there's a bad attitude, that there's a sense of get off the road, get out of the way, this kind of thing, which I think is, if you feel that way, you really need to look at yourself.
Absolutely.
Because this is different now, but we were chatting a little bit. I've seen people have road rage over cyclists on the road, and I'm like, do you want to go so far as to, like, you see people cut them off really fast and you're like, that's someone's person. Are you willing to like prove a point and kill them?
Yeah.
Like road rage.
It's road rage, yeah.
It's insane. It's insane. There's a lot of anger on the roads in general, I find. That to me, if you're angry at someone's road, you need, and I know people do stupid things in the road, but if you're angry about it, you need to go and get some therapy for yourself.
You need, you
that's
do.
Your shit.
It's you problem.
This is just side note.
Yeah, yeah.
But it really bothers me because I'm like, if you're angry at someone on the roads, you shouldn't be angry. Okay. Anyway, again, that's debating. But when it comes to road safety, you obviously know so much now. And I know you were on Prime Time yourself and your mum, and you were speaking about there are changes that are happening in other countries.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit to people who don't really understand the dangers of that left turn with a truck, especially a HGV?
Yeah.
What is the issue and what should be done about it?
Yeah, so following on from the Prime Time, myself and my mum were in Leinster House there 2 weeks ago, and we met the Minister, Sean Canny, to speak about safety on the roads. And that's as straightforward as it is, it's safety on the roads. Obviously, there's a lot I can say and a lot I can't say.
Yeah.
There is a lot of factors involved in what happened.
Mm.
You know, it's an accumulation of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's accumulation of the junction.
Yeah.
It's accumulation of a residential area.
Yeah.
A truck that size been in a residential area at that time. There's accumulation of things. But when Primetime reached out to us, a lovely reporter reached out to us, and he was very, very, very kind, and he was very sympathetic. He was really lovely to deal with. He reached out to us a long time ago, and myself and my man weren't able. And as time went on, we just said, you know, we actually, people, I don't know, some people might find this strange, but again, like I said, everyone's grief is their own. My mom feels my dad down at that junction in Castleknock. So she goes down and she sits there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she sits there. And numerous times we've analysed that junction. And we have seen cyclists get off their bikes at that junction and go up on the path because the junction's so unsafe. But when the journalist reached out to us, he sent us a really good article. And he said, this is what we want to base the prime time around. Can you have a look and see what you think? And not to get into technicalities of it, it's very, very simple. It's HGV, big truck, and on the left-hand side of it, there's 10 red cyclists. So they say that the left-hand side on a big truck like that is a blind spot.
Mm.
In my opinion, if there's a blind spot and you're aware of it, there should be extra sensors fitted.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us back to the legislation that's been brought in the UK.
Yeah.
They have been brought in. They have fitted these HGV trucks that aren't roadworthy. They're not roadworthy. If there's a blind spot, they have fitted them all now with extra sensors.
And that's the law in the UK. You can't have a truck unless it has these sensors.
Absolutely.
Against the law.
Absolutely, yeah. And in the article, there is the HGV truck and there's 10 red cyclists on the left.
Mm.
Out of them 10 cyclists, there's only 2 are green.
Yeah.
And they're to the middle.
Yeah.
Where there's no, you're not in sight.
So it's a mock-up visual of pretend, it's like an animation, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Of cyclists.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I saw it in the Primetime.
Yeah.
Program.
Yeah.
And it shows visually how many people that driver cannot see if they're on the left-hand side.
Yeah. And Dad was one of them red cyclists up the front.
Not visible.
Not visible. You know, not visible. Now, Dad was lit up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah.
He had big fluorescent green jacket on him, had a fluorescent lights, had a fluorescent bag,
He
was lit up like a Christmas tree.
He did everything right.
He did. And something that's being said to us, you know, was he an experienced cyclist? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Are you an experienced driver? Like, it's everybody on air roads deserves to be safe.
Yeah.
But you're walking, cycling.
Yeah.
But that legislation brought in the UK, we are trying to get that in here. Not us. We as
a country
are trying to bring that in here, you know, and we spoke to the minister about, you know, road safety, you know, and those big trucks in residential areas, blind spots, like they need to be fitted with extra sensors.
Mm.
Is it going to take for another life to be lost on the roads for something to be done?
And it's increasing.
It's increasing.
The number of people killed on the road.
Yeah.
Cyclists.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you're talking there, I'm thinking it's all about, like, you know, once upon a time, it wasn't against the law not to wear a seatbelt.
Yeah.
It's about safety.
Absolutely.
And we now know, like, as you say, it's a lot different to a car colliding with a cyclist. Like, you've no chance. A HGV with a full load. Like, there's
it's
no chance.
Fully loaded.
Yeah.
They had to get a crane to lift the truck off. My dad, this was fully loaded.
Oh my God, Hazelyn, that's horrific.
You know, it's, again, and, you know, Dad got the cycle to work scheme because he wanted to get fit. They want you to stay away from public transport. Well, use public transport, port, not cycle.
To reduce the
reduce
traffic.
The traffic and cycle to work, use public transport, etc. If the roads aren't fit for purpose and aren't safe,
Yeah.
For all road users.
Yeah.
But a lot of it comes down to the people behind the wheel, the people, you know, it's accumulation of things.
Yeah, of course.
It's an accumulation of things,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. It's not just one particular thing. It's not clear cut, but it is about safety is the name of the game. And it's like everybody needs to do better.
Yeah. Like a lot of people since the prime time have reached out to us and had said to us, it's only after watching the prime time, we are aware that at loads of junctions have them, but at the junction where my dad was killed, there is an actual box on front. But cars come up this far.
Yeah.
There's a box on front. That's a cycle box. Cars aren't meant to go in there. Buses aren't meant to go in there. People are more aware now. There needs to be more awareness. Yeah.
So it's about looking at those markings on the road. So there was, I watched the prime time, as I said.
Yeah.
And that actual junction where your dad was, there was a clear box for cyclists.
Yeah.
So the traffic should be staying back behind.
Yeah.
But we know that people can be really impatient.
Absolutely.
They just move forward and they're not looking at these things.
But that impatient, that one impatient minute can take a daddy. Like my dad was a dad, is a dad, a husband, a work colleague, a friend. You know, people need to bear that. This is someone's life.
Yeah.
Not just in any situation. You know, when you're using the roads, you're responsible for yourself and other people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and act as if.
Yeah, the impulsiveness.
Flying around the place in a car or whatever. Like, you are a danger.
Yeah.
Even a car, you're a danger. Like, people that's walking or cycling can't survive, a collision. So, 9 times out of 10, like, you're in. You have the advantage.
Yeah. Like unprotected cycle lanes are such an issue.
Yeah.
Dad was in an unprotected cycle lane.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's no point of having a cycle lane if it's unprotected.
Yeah.
You know? So again, that's...
It needs to be looked at.
It needs to be looked at. And that's what we're trying to raise the awareness and...
Yeah. Make it safer for people.
I just don't want anyone else to have to go through what we're going through. And if by... speaking about our grief and trauma, and that can help one person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's about changing attitudes as well, isn't it?
It's so, you know, people are so judgmental.
Yeah.
So judgmental.
I know.
I've found people so judgmental, and people are very nasty.
Yeah.
And, like, you never know what people are going through.
No.
You know, so it's very important to just think before you speak sometimes. Yeah. You know, like the simple comments of, I get all, oh God, you look great. If it's any consolation, you know, you look great.
Oh, Jesus, that would just, I couldn't cope.
And I'm like.
What does it matter?
No, my pain is not visible. My pain is in here. And just so, I think, what are we meant to do? Not wash our hair. Not get dressed. You know, if we lie in bed all day and pull the covers over our head, does that mean we're not okay?
Mm.
I can't. Me and my mum can't do that because we won't come back from that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to try and survive.
But it doesn't equal anything.
No.
Just looking good doesn't match anything.
No.
As you said, your pain isn't visible. I would love to just maybe bring it into the present day on a day-to-day basis. What is that loss like? You know, the loss of your dad, when you walk home and open the door and he's not there, what's the hardest things for you?
It's really, every time it happens, I die again. That's the only way of describing it. I die again. You know, I'm trying to be strong for my mum. Because my mum is, you know, people would have that, no, my mum would, you know, she's always bubbly, outgoing, and she's not that person now. She's lost my dad, like her other half.
Mm.
So I tried to be strong for her. Walking into the house and him not being there. You know, so we have my dad's ashes home. They're in the sitting room. I struggle to be there. Because I don't want to see him in a box. Simple things like somebody asking me a question in work and I'm saying, oh, I'll ring my dad and ask him. I can't do that. It's like getting getting shot every day. That's what it's like. It's that moment, you have a moment of realization that this hasn't happened. So I always say it's how my day is. One part of the day, my brain tells me nothing's happened. Your dad's coming home. But it gets to a point in the day where I have to go home and I know he's not coming home. And that's when it starts all over again. And people think, oh, you need to keep busy. You know, it's great being back to work and, you know, keep yourself busy and have a distraction. I don't want a distraction. Because I don't want to forget what's going on. Because then I feel like I'm losing my dad all over again. Mm. But nothing will distract you from what you're up and what we're going through.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. And, you know, getting and going back to, I struggle being back to work. You know, I struggle. And people say going back to work was the best thing you ever done. Absolutely not. I struggle being back to work. The exhaustion of that comes with grief is unnatural.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm exhausted 24/7.
Is your sleep bad?
Very bad.
Yeah.
My sleep is really, really bad. So I could go into a deep, deep sleep at 11 o'clock and I wake up absolutely sweating. I mean, the bed is drowned. I'm sweating. And then I'm wide awake then. I could be watching something on Netflix at 2, 3 and 4 in the morning. Then your alarm goes off for work and you have to get up. And I have to face people every single day.
And that's not easy, facing the public.
Oh my God, I deal with the public. There's so many parts of grief. And say there's 10 parts of grief. Must go through them 10 parts every minute.
Yeah.
It's
the anger, the exhaustion, the fog.
The brain fog.
The physical pain.
It's real.
It's all happening at the one time.
Yeah.
What is it like for you at the moment? You're approaching the first anniversary. Are you feeling a build up there?
Yeah.
Are you?
I'm dreading it.
Are you?
Yeah. It's, we're actually going down Christmas Day to my dad's best friend, Alan, in Galway. You know, Alan is really after taking over.
That's lovely.
The daddy figure, he really has. Yeah. He hasn't forgotten about, and people have forgotten about us. And that happens. You know, people have forgotten about us. Alan hasn't. And he's been consistent all the time. He invited us down for Christmas Day. We actually don't call it Christmas.
Yeah.
We're just saying it's just another day.
Yeah, but it's a big thing. Everyone's talking about it now. And I'm hearing it, obviously, because I suppose I've a support community set up.
Yeah.
The amount of people that are like struggling, like either so...
It's really hard.
It's coming in on them. And I'm trying to say that. I'm like, it's just a day. It's a day.
Totally day.
It was created by, you know... Marketing to make
companies.
Presents.
It's a day.
Buy, spend.
That's what it is.
That's what it's about.
If we've no decorations up, we won't.
Yeah.
We had our Christmas decorations up and they were taken down the next day last year.
Really? Yeah.
No, absolutely not. We won't do Christmas tree, nothing like that, because it's not Christmas without Dad.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
So it's the way it is coming up now. We have his first year's mass on the 20th. Of December. And the way it is, we're just trying to survive every day till we get to the 19th, we get to the 20th, we'll get through Christmas. You know, Dad's funeral was New Year's Eve. So we get through New Year's, and then them days that people speak about are over, but we just go back to the way we are again. It's very important coming up to Christmas for other people as well. You need to be kind to yourself. You need to be kind to yourself. And if you're having a bad day or you feel like crap, just acknowledge it. Just acknowledge it, because no one can comment on how you're feeling because they're not going through it. You know?
Yeah, and it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, from listening to your podcasts, I've heard other people speak and it's kind of said to me, no, it's actually okay how I'm feeling. Again, if it was spoken about more, people would understand. You know, it's very hard to navigate through grief because you're not built for this.
Well, there's no rule book.
There's no rule book.
No one says, well, now I'm going to tell, don't worry, I'll tell you what happens and how it goes. There's no one knows.
No, like my mom lost her parents. And like mom said, I've experienced grief. This isn't grief. This is not what I experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Again, it goes back to the how. It's like the details of what happened adds so much more to it for you guys anyway. And all that, as you said, all the things that come with it, that like you're still waiting. You're still waiting to understand what happened. So you are frozen in time. You can't actually sit and process everything, even if you wanted to, because you don't know everything.
Don't know. No.
You know, and you didn't get a goodbye.
No.
You didn't get to say goodbye.
No.
Like to sit that, with that.
That'll never leave you.
Exactly.
No.
I mean, I had my sister, you know, all the way. I held her hand to the end. Now, again, I'm not, is that's in itself watching someone suffering.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's horrendous
yeah.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different. It's mm-hmm. different for everybody. I could never relate to you. I could never be like, oh, I get what you're going through, because I don't, because it's so different. That part alone, to not be able to hold their hand. Like, that's devastating. It's devastating. I can't even imagine the trauma it brings
yeah.
every single day, knowing that you didn't get to see them that one last time
yeah.
or hold them, or like, I can't.
And you start to regret then as well. And you say, oh, you know, we were planning on going into City Centre. We're doing a Christmas Day every year, me, my mum, my dad. And we get the bus in. And dad was killed on a Thursday. We were doing it on a Saturday. And we go into the Ivy for a cocktail. We look in Grafton Street. We go into Brown Thomas, Arnott's, have a nosy. And then we finish off in the church. And we have wings and a drink. Every year, that was our Christmas Day.
The three of you?
Yeah. So, mom texted dad that day and said, Derek, dad was finishing up for Christmas. He said, Derek, I booked the Ivy. And he texts her back and he goes, oh my God, I can't wait. Loving this. Can't wait for this. Really looking forward to it. And that was the last thing she heard from him. And then I say to myself, why didn't I ring him that day? Why didn't I text him? Why did we have that silly argument 15 years ago? Do you know? That's what comes with it.
Yeah.
It you is. Know?
Yeah.
Where if I had been with him towards the end and had been able to say goodbye and hold his hand, could I have told him all these things?
You know?
I don't know, because I never got that chance.
No.
That's, you know,
and that's what it is. That's what you're living with now. All those,
yeah,
coulda, woulda, shoulda,
yeah. And
it's difficult.
They would destroy your brain.
Yeah,
they would. You know,
yeah,
they would.
Because there's nothing you can actually do about it now.
You can't run away from your brain.
Yeah,
you can't. You know,
I know. Yeah, I know. You can't switch it off sometimes.
No,
and it's like we were saying earlier. You see addiction. A lot of times people are switching that off through medicating and alcohol. And yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I understand.
It's a hard place to be in your brain sometimes, isn't it?
Your brain is your worst enemy.
Mm.
You know, and then we have a long, long road ahead of us.
You do.
A long road ahead of us. And I suppose the only thing is we want to survive it.
Yeah. I think you're very much in the here and now.
Yeah.
You're at the real start almost.
Yeah.
Like, you're not a person that can come on here and this is what's important, because there are so many people that are in the here and now.
Yeah.
You know, so many people that got a traumatic phone call, unfortunately, today or yesterday.
Yeah.
And something horrendous happened on the road, or, you know, and those people are in the here and the now, and they need to hear someone, and they need to hear someone that they can relate to. That's why it is important to document all stages. Like, you will be a different woman in 5 years' time, because you will have your answers and you'll have worked through that. I'm not saying it's going to be better,
mm-hmm.
but I'm just saying you'll be different.
Yeah.
You will be in a different place.
Yeah.
Whether that be good or bad, I don't know.
Yeah.
You'll be in a different place. But right now, your experience is where it is.
Yeah. And here and now, yeah.
Yeah. You're going through a lot for different reasons, because you haven't had an inquest yet. You haven't had answers that you need. You're not even at the first year yet.
Oh.
You're still, as you say, detached almost, numb.
Absolutely. It's numb. That's the
But you know what? Yeah. The thing about it is that's okay too.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. And it's okay. And I know that a lot of people in people's lives are trying to will them on to get better. As in, come, you know, maybe get some counselling and that'll fix you. Or, you know, you're looking great and you're about to work good on you. Like, we need to just take someone where they're at.
Absolutely.
Your life, to me, is in tatters at the moment.
Yeah.
And fair play to you, you're getting up and you're going to work. That's brilliant. But at the same time, I know that you are no longer the girl you were.
No.
You are not okay.
No.
You know, you're just about functioning.
Just about, yeah.
Fair play to you, as I say. But I know that is not easy. And I know it doesn't mean you're fixed.
No.
And you never will be.
No.
That's the piece I just wish people would understand.
I'm the same. Absolutely. I think if anything, I've learned a lot from this. I have. I've learned a lot of what to say and what not to say.
Yeah.
You know, there is just, if you don't know what to say, just don't say anything.
Yeah.
Just don't. Or just, you know, I've even said,
thinking of you.
Being back to, when I was back to work and I'm really good friends and work, and they said, look, we'll let people know you're coming back just so they have an idea, and we're just going to say to them, say, it's lovely to see you back. And that was really nice.
Yeah.
It's great to see you back to work. It's nice to see you, or it's lovely to have you back.
Yeah.
You know, don't say to me, oh God, you know, it's, you know, or people would say to me, is your mum not back to work yet? And I'm like, well, how could she be?
Yeah.
You know, so there's a judgmental side of grief as well. And is it intentional? No, I don't think so. But it's, again, people that haven't experienced it, I think, don't know how to.
No, they don't know. They don't have the language.
They don't have the language.
You don't speak that language. I'm
no.
Happy for you.
I wish I wasn't. I wish I didn't know how to speak that language.
In it.
Yeah, I wish I didn't. But the reality is I am in it.
Yeah. And certain people will speak your language. Others don't.
Yeah.
Is there anything, just before we finish, I'm wondering, is there anything that you do that helps you, even like walking or going into bed or baths or is there therapy? Is there any little things at all in this early, early stage that you found helps you? Helps you even, because I imagine it's very physical for you at the moment, like the anxiety and the fear. And is there anything that you find kind of helps you with that? Or not? If there's nothing, there's nothing.
Yeah. So I never ran. Never. And about, that was the 19th of December, probably the end of January, start of February, I was in a bad place. And I said, you can go down one road or you can go down another road. And I chose exercise. So I started running.
Good woman.
Yeah. I started running and I actually ran the Dublin, the Women's Marathon, the 10K, and I ran it for the Irish Road Victims Association.
Good.
And I raised money to help other families that are going through what I'm going through that can't afford grief counselling, need some help, you know, barristers, solicitors. So I picked up the running. So I would go out for a run and I just find that, you know, how long it takes me to run 5 or 10K, in that time, I'm concentrating on keeping running and staying up on my feet. I don't think about anything.
Yeah.
And it's like my brain sorts out what's been going on
yeah.
for that yeah. couple of minutes. Once I'm finished running.
You're back into it.
No, you are, but you feel a small bit better.
Yeah.
You know, I go to the gym.
Yeah, even that tiny bit.
Yeah, I do.
It's a release.
It's a release.
Yeah.
I go to the gym.
An escape even.
Yeah.
And for 5 minutes.
Yeah, and I talk.
Yeah.
I do. I talk and I don't be afraid to speak about what happened.
Yeah.
You know, because being afraid to speak about what happened, it makes you feel worse because you're holding it in. So to be, you know, to be confident to speak about what's after happening,
yeah.
that helps a lot as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It was really nice to hear about your dad and I hope that you keep talking about him.
Thank you.
And all the good he did.
I will.
How fun he was.
Yeah.
And I have no doubt he'd be so, so proud of me.
I hope so.
Girl, of course
yeah.
he would. Of course he would. I wish you well in the weeks coming ahead because I know
it's very
really
much.
Difficult. But thank you for everything yeah. you've given us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you.